session number 30493, Reel 20.
Having had some experience of the post-war gloom and depression, have you any opinions on how best to deal with that sort of thing?
Well, sympathy, that's the first thing. Sympathy, understanding. Because it's like the popular attitude to depression is, oh, come on, buck up. You know, buck up. That's it. Ridiculous, of course. The last thing somebody in that state is going to do is just buck up and snap out of it. Snap out of it, you know. Now it needs sympathetic and trained people to cope with that. But, you know, I mean, in NHS, it's an all-embracing service, and of course it's something I was totally for, and it was part of the beverage scheme, you know, which was every soldier was told about the beverage scheme, this scheme of pensions and medical care and the rest of it during the war, and we expected it after the war, no doubt about it. We didn't want Churchill, as I made it quite clear. Churchill was great as a war leader to this day. I mean, everybody did terrible, bloody blunders. Italy shouldn't have happened. But what a war leader he was, you know. He did rally at a terrible, terrible, lonely time for Britain. He rallied the country. I've nothing for praise, actually, for Winnie. And I hate him politically. Totally. It's a terrible record. He turned the army out 4 times in peacetime to interfere politically. Unforgivable. And he was never forgiven by a great mass of British people. And when they went into uniform and fought a war under him, they didn't want him back in civilian life. And it was a great shock to the ruling class, no doubt about it. Terrible shock. So I guess that there are, I think there is no doubt about it, that there are, it is help for people who've been affected. I mean, the government's reacted quickly to this report that there's, at least I hope they're acting quickly, to this report that brain-damaged soldiers are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq.
And what about on the part of the individual themselves?
Well, well, it's important, yes. This is the problem, really, that a lot of people don't realise that help is possible, I think. This is a tragic thing. A tragic thing. I mean, my wife is very much involved with cancer care people. She fought cancer and won some years ago. And ever since, she's been dedicated to it, helping other people. And how those poor women, they don't seem to realise that help and advice is available. And Nita speaks all the time over the phone. She's one of the people who listens to cancer people, cancer victims. And she lends a sympathetic, understanding and informed help over the phone, and it's amazing how the people at the other end of the telephone suddenly their whole attitude to their cancer changes, because suddenly they're having a sympathetic answers to their worried questions, and their terrible ignorance of really of the disease that's affecting them. Nita now is very much involved at also in fundraising, and he's been congratulated and by a number of official sources. But that's it, you see, a victim, whether it's of war or cancer, they want information, but they also want a sympathetic ear. Those are the two things. Informed information to answer all their worried, fearful questions, and a totally sympathetic, understanding ear. That's the answer to traumas of all kinds, I think. Essential. And I do hope that these... I mean, you'd have to pursue that question into NHS circles to get a full answer today.
On the subject of the post-war politics, did you take part in the 1945 elections?
I would, there again, I would certainly have been, you know, when politics came up in the army, I would certainly have been offering a left-wing view of the world, no doubt about it. I mean, the information I was getting, I like to say I've never joined a political party in my life, but during the war, and there was an organisation set up by Sir Richard Ackland. He was a big landowner in the West Country, and he set up this organisation called Commonwealth, and J.B. Priestley and people like that. I mean, Priestley was another one of those people whose voice over the radio added enormously to the morale of the nation. He gave these, I think they're called fireside talks. They were published, and they were very down. He had this nice, friendly Yorkshire voice, and people turned to that voice during the war. I'm sure he's really a valuable asset, no doubt about it, on that morale level, the propaganda level. Although basically he was such an honest man about everything, but he was definitely a socialist, and Richard Anglin was socialist. But they went a bit to the left of the Labour Party with this Commonwealth. Now, that it appealed to the armed forces insofar as they knew about it, because Ackland, who was a big landowner in the West Country, he just gave his land. He gave it to the country, so to speak, and was no longer a big landlord. That made somebody not only talked about socialism but acted in a socialist way. That was very impressive. Where during wartime, where words needed actions to prove their value and importance. So briefly, I joined. I must have joined Commonwealth, and their literature arrived. And I remember there was a covering letter which more or less said to the commanding officer, "This soldier must read this literature or else," something like that. So there was no way that it could have been censored or impounded. With the exactly was an MP, so he had this parliamentary power to ensure that his literature reached the people in uniform. So that would have been one of the steps in my political awareness and development, without a doubt. It's there again, it's there in my war diary. Then there was a literature sent to me by my Hampstead pen friend, clippings from various... a very good one on Italy. I came across recently, 1944, from the New Statesman, pointing out that as the towns and villages of Italy were being liberated, got the army people were turning to the wrong Italians. But more too often we were using the old fascist regime to maintain law and order. So I was aware, you see, of these growing questions about our policy in Italy. And of course, since then, I've come across literature which is quite remarkable. For instance, America's Secret Army, which is the untold story of the Counterintelligence Corps. Now, they were active in Italy, you see, when I was there. So, here's America's Secret Army. Now, it's written by Douglas Botting, who, in fact, was a customer of ours. He used to come to our warehouse and dig around our stock and buy material that ended up in his books. So I feel quite pleased that we helped. He wrote an incredible book called Nazi Gold. Now, there, I mean, Hitler grabbed all the gold he could while he master of Europe. Now, what happened to it? It disappeared. Now, Douglas Botting went on the trail for that, and he wrote this extraordinary book. I can't find the copy, I must have somewhere. But of course, the higher up he went up the chain of command, so to speak, the more murky it became. And I've forgotten how far he got. But, you know, the missing Nazi gold, it's still missing. You know, where did it end? There's a big question mark for history. And the CIC, was active, winkling out fascist sympathisers in Italy. As we moved up Italy, along came this American counterintelligence corps. And the book shows how they really were intelligent. They got professors and academics of all kinds and recruited them. And these were well informed, not the kind of stupid CIA men you get after the war. These were really, and of course, what Douglas Botting failed to discover, despite all his investigations here in a 400-page book, is that the head of it, the X2 counterintelligence component, was Jesus Angleton. Now, this extraordinary man was he didn't exist apparently. Dotting didn't discover him, and yet he ended up the top man in the CIA. And utterly paranoid, totally paranoid. He practically destroyed the CIA while he was at the head of it after the war. That's quite a story. There, and it begins in Italy, 1944. it's endless, this quest for truth about that campaign. I'm still discovering information today that I didn't. I mean, what set me on this trail, was the Imperial War Museum review. Do you see that? Does it still come out? It's the Imperial War Museum. This is number 4. So, and this, in fact, began my contemplation of contacting them, because it contains it's 1989, this issue. And it contained images of war in Italy. The record made by the Army Film and Photographic Unit in Emilia-Romagna, 1944-1945. And it's written by an Italian specialist, Gianfranco Casadio. That's a very interesting illustrated article there. Also, photography again is an appreciation of the shelter photographs taken by Bill Brandt in London in 1940. In the underground, wonderful photos of people sheltering from the bombing in the underground. Then is another is moving the Parliamentary Recruiting Committee poster campaign in the First World War. And then there's another marvellous article, French Pro-Nazi Forces, an introduction to parties, personalities and posters in collaborationist France, 1940-44. And then there's another article, the German Biber submarine. Now, that alerted me to the fact that I got photos of the Biber submarines. Was a Nazi submarine designed with one man could operate it, and it was functioning in the Mediterranean. And at some point, we just at the end of the war, we were at the seaside leave, and on the shore there were two of these ex-Nazi one-man submarines, known as the Biber submarine. And I've got a photo of myself sitting in the turret, giving the Nazi salute. So, you know, after reading, and then at the end there, there's a Ministry of Information and documentary film, 39-45. So it was a fascinating issue, and it alerted me to the fact that, well, you know, my photos might well fit into that collection of 10 million photos. Now there are 10,800,000 photos in the archives. So that's, I don't know quite how I got hold of that. But then when it came into my hands, I thought, well, you know, I've got a diary and I've got all those photos. Perhaps they are of historic interest to one day, to future generations even. Who knows? Anyway, worth a try, and here we are.
Would you be able to explain your experience of the confrontation with Tito?
Would I be able to? In what way?
Just to explain the...
Well, I could only explain it by knowledge acquired after the war, really, and what's in my diary. I mean, there again, you say, what do I recall? And up pop these photos. Here's a little group of Tito's partisans. They're girl partisans. I've got this nice shot of the three of them. They don't notice me. I get a nice photo of them chatting. And then we were at a football match playing Tito's a crack team. And every time we played them, we always lost. We're still losing today, aren't we? And there I've got this silhouetted against the sky. There's a whole crowd of partisans sitting on the wall watching the football match. And then, of course, I've got this marvellous photo of Mark Clark and General Hardy trying to nipping by our truck and gun and us almost killing them in the process. And I've got this wonderful photo of them. And then I've got a photo of the first time as we went charging up the road to, although it may have been later, it was when Tito's men agreed to withdraw from Trieste. So I've got this nice shot of a partisan unit on the road marching out of the Trieste area with their red badges on their forage caps. And it's interesting, in the changeover, as they were leaving, one day we were I think it was a steep hill. We were in a truck, and as we went up this steep hill, we came across a horse-drawn vehicle with parties there, and it had ditched, I think. Anyway, they were in trouble, so we stopped the truck and jumped off and helped them out of their trouble. I've forgotten exactly what it was, and helped them up this steep hill with the this horse-drawn vehicle. And then when we finished, the partisans all sort of stood to attention and gave us a cracking salute in farewell. And it was a lovely moment there. I can remember that. No photo there, but that is in my memory. And so, of course, it is in there again, is it? It's in my memory. It's in my war diary, really. No, it's not in my memory, is it? No, it's there in the war diary, and I've just recaptured the incident.
You, off the tape, you mentioned that you had some strong moral objections to...
Oh, absolutely, yes. I was really cut up about it. No doubt about it. I would have ended up being... I mean, I just can't bear to think. Anyway, I told you perhaps earlier, did I? Alexander, I mean, Churchill said, gave out his orders, get to Trieste before Tito does. Simple as that. And Alexander was expected to carry that order out. And instead, this is all now in the secret documents that have been released. Instead, he sends a return telegram saying that he led his men in the army he'd led in Italy. He was not really prepared to ask them to fight Tito's partisans, as they'd been told all along that they were allies in the war against Hitler, you know, and they've been fighting bravely. Words to that effect, I don't remember the exact words. And because Churchill was furious with Alexander, it's all there, the exchange of documents. But Alexander had his way. He wasn't going to. I mean, there again, in my diary it says, we would put our guns ready for action, but this was Alexander's order, I suppose, we would not adopt a warlike position. It doesn't really make sense to me that, you know, when you've got your guns there. We were in action. Our guns were pointing at Tito's men, and in the woods behind us there were 200 shells hidden away. But they were there, they were hidden. Nevertheless, there again, this isn't in my diary, but this is a memory, a very distinct memory. Our guns were there, ready for action. We hadn't dug in or anything, but they're pointing in the right direction, you might say. And right through our lines came this officer, a partisan officer, on this lovely white horse. And of course he was, his sharp eyes were observing everything in sight, you know. And he just rode through and disappeared out into the... So I remember how strange that seemed, you know. But here we are, all mixed up. But we were... There's nothing but goodwill, really, about everybody there in Trieste, as far as I know. I mean, we played football with them. We went to the... I think there again, it's in my diary, we went to the cinema, open-air cinema, and we were sitting there shoulder to shoulder with the partisans watching a film. We were inextricably mixed up, involved in this city of Trieste. Well, at the same time, as I say, in my diary it says the people round the table are deciding whether or not we go for each other's throats. I couldn't contemplate that. I just could not have participated. And I think Alexander was a very wise, shrewd general and knew he couldn't get his army shooting at Tito's men, not after being portrayed as such heroes. And the suffering of the Yugoslavs. And you have to remember, they were the only country in Europe that fought back. Hitler's panzer divisions poured across Europe. And of course the Russians eventually fought back after falling back hundreds of miles. They fought back. But the other European countries caved in, one after the other. The royal families of in each town, each country, they disappeared abroad, came to Britain. Yugoslav government in exile, King Peace of Yugoslavia, spent the war in London. And he was expected to go back. And Churchill wanted him back, you see. That's why he wanted Tito out of Trieste. There was a turning point in the war, though the word Cold War hadn't been invented then. It was the beginning of the Cold War, and I seem to sense it, that somehow the war had taken... the war was over in Europe, but suddenly here we were, still in uniform, and there was this 180% degree turn in policy taking place. I mean, I must have sensed that, because it's all there in the diary. A very deep sense of a fear that of another conflict. And there we are for the next, 40 years? We were in a Cold War, with a war quite possible breaking out again, a third world war, an atomic war that would have destroyed civilization. We were on the edge of it until the collapse of communism.
A terrible time. You would have been prepared to refuse to take part?
Well, I see, I mean, just, you know, the diaries say I was quite prepared. I mean, it's all supposition, isn't it? We can't possibly know what might have happened, but we can guess it would have been pretty nasty. I mean, God, the partisans would have fought back so ferociously, but the power of the Allies at the end of the war was so tremendous. I mean, we flattened half of Europe. I mean, on the way home, a special route, when the armies at the end of the war in Italy got their leave to London, a special route had to be mapped out right across the ruined Europe, and camps were set up periodically across Europe, and these leave parties would go. And on the way, when it was my turn, now from the back of this leave truck, it took us 6 days, I think, a week, to travel across Europe. And there was nothing but desolation and misery and shattered towns and villages. It's horrific. We'd laid Europe waste with the bombing. And we would have done the same with we'd have succeeded where the Nazis failed. We'd have flattened Yugoslavia. I just and there would Stalin have allowed that? He'd have suddenly called in the Red Army, I suppose, because the Red Army were in Yugoslavia at that time. At the last 3 months of the war, the Red Army had moved in, was fighting capturing the Nazis and defeating them at the other the Austrian side. To contemplate such a conflict, I mean, and to think that we would be on the side of the attackers. It was inconceivable to me. I would have, well, punishment, I don't know what it would have been then, I suppose. The reputation of the glass house, which was the military institution for punishment, was pretty awful, I suppose intentionally. They were portrayed as places where you were really truly punished if you were sentenced to a glass house, which were military prisons in the Middle East and Italy.